For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. During 2025, we are going to be making a concerted effort to have more political figures joining us on the morning show from time to time. And I can think of no better way to begin that effort than to welcome back into our studios State Senator Robert Wirch, who serves the 22nd State Senate District, which includes just about all of the city of Kenosha, some of Racine, and other villages in between for much of southeastern Wisconsin. Robert Wirch is our senator. He has served in the state Senate since 1997, following in the footsteps of a legend in that body, John Andrea. Before that, Robert Wirch served for several years in the state assembly, and before that, served on the Kenosha County Board of Supervisors. And born and raised here in Kenosha with strong ties to the community. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Senator Wirch, not only about some of the pressing issues that he and his colleagues are contending with, but also talking about the way in which he has sought to serve his constituents, and in particular, the way in which his office is structured and functions, the way in which he continues to seek to connect with voters, with the citizens of southeastern Wisconsin. So we have a lot of ground to cover, and I appreciate you joining us, Senator Robert Wirch. We welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, Greg, thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
It's been a long time, and I'm glad we can have this conversation once again. Actually, I think it would be great to take care of a bit of background, including the fact that I just touched on that you are born and raised here in Kenosha. The Wirch family goes back even at least a couple of generations before you. And I think it would be interesting for people to just hear a bit about the way in which your work with the local union was really your gateway into the world of politics. Explain that connection.
Well, I always tell people I'm a third-generation factory worker. My grandfather, Albert, came from Ukraine. Oh. We're German, but back in history, they wanted more people in Ukraine, and he was a farmer, and they lived there for several years, and then the politics changed. All of a sudden, the Germans weren't popular in Ukraine, so they decided to come to this country. My grandfather got a job at the American Brass Company in Kenosha. My father worked at the American Brass Company, and I worked at the American Brass Company. But I was always interested in politics, and thank God for University of Wisconsin Parkside. I was able to go to school in the evenings and finally get my degree. And I was always interested in politics and the history of this great country.
You ended up running for the Kenosha Board of Supervisors, and then ultimately took the plunge to run for the State Assembly, where you were following in the footsteps of John Antaramian, who was shifting his attention towards ultimately, of course, becoming mayor of Kenosha. What was it like to make that step from local government to Madison? Did that feel like a gigantic leap?
Well, back then, that was in the 80s, 1986, when John Collins was the county executive, we got along. It was crazy. I mean, in these partisan times, I look back at the time on the county board and supervisors west of the I and the county supervisors and the city supervisors got along and tried to do what was best for Kenosha County. And I think back to those days, Stanley Kirkman and Fred Schmalfeld and other people like that. I served with Bob Pitts and good people who put the county first. Unfortunately, you know, even on the county board now, partisanship has taken over. And I think that's sad because we should all remember, all of us elected officials, that we are public servants and we are there to do what's best, not for party ideology, but what's best for our citizens.
Let's talk for a moment about the way in which you seek to do exactly that in terms of serving your constituents and serving the state of Wisconsin. And you were telling me before we went on the air that there are a couple of different ways in which your own office, your own staff function a bit differently from that of a lot of your colleagues.
Yes, and let me make clear that I'm in the first year of a four-year term. I was blessed to be reelected. I didn't have opposition, but we don't rest on our laurels. And today, I mentioned, is going to be a nice day in Kenosha. It's supposed to be around 40 degrees. My staff will be out there knocking on doors. And the message is simply this. They give my card to people. They ask them, do you have any questions? Do you need any help from our office? And if not, we just leave the card. And there's two reasons we do that. One, a lot of people don't know who the hell their state senator is. So we want to we want to inform them of that. And number two, I want my staff to meet the people that they represent. You know, we're low budget. We don't have an office in Kenosha or Racine. We don't have the kind of money that a congressman does. So we have to reach out and knock on doors and walk through the neighborhoods. And we believe that is part of basic democracy. And then I'll be holding a listening session next week. And so we try and have listening sessions to help people with their problems, hear their opinions on the state budget, on legislation, and help them with problems. Hopefully we can resolve those problems. Mm.
Is that always the way your office has functioned with that attention towards knocking on doors?
Yes. Our philosophy is this. Issues come and go, but if you help someone solve a problem, they never forget.
Mm. We're speaking with State Senator Robert Wirch, who serves most of the city of Kenosha, some of the city of Racine, and other areas like Summers and Sturtevant and much of Pleasant Prairie, Mount Pleasant, and so on, much of the southeastern corner of the state of Wisconsin. It was an interesting election year in Wisconsin in terms of the state assembly and the state senate, and you being a Democrat have to be pleased with the way in which some of the numbers turned out, and particularly in the way in which a number of seats flipped towards the Democrats, with Republican majorities still in place, but majorities that are much more narrow than they once were. First of all, were you surprised by those results, by those numbers?
I'm a bad prognosticator on elections in Wisconsin because the people surprise you so many times. But we had better maps to work with. The Republicans had gerrymandered the maps before, and quite frankly, I was one of the winners. I got the people in my district, the previous map that the Republicans didn't want. they didn't want the city people, and they wanted the more rural people, and so because they're more Republican. And don't get me wrong, the Democrats have done the same thing in Illinois, gerrymandering maps, as the Republicans did in Wisconsin. But with the maps declared unconstitutional and better maps in there, first of all, that's good for democracy. People are not going to vote if districts are all one-sided. But if they see a competitive race, they're going to come out and vote. So with the new maps, the Democrats picked up seats, 4 seats in the Senate and about 10 seats in the Assembly.
You were also saying that there are even more new faces than that. I mean, that in addition to those 10 Assembly seats that flipped from Republican to Democrat, that we also have some new Democrat faces in the state assembly. I don't remember how many you said, but...
Look, I always laugh at the people who say, well, we should have term limits. Well, they don't understand there's a natural turnover in the state legislature. Now, in the Democratic caucus, I mentioned 10 new Democrats who defeated Republicans. But there's also 13 more that replaced other Democrats. In other words, 23 new members in the Democratic caucus. Why? Because people get tired of driving to Madison. They get tired of the partisanship. They want to do something else in life. And like I say, some of them get defeated. So there's a natural turnover in the state legislature. So why have term limits? I don't understand. You want your best people there, and you want a cross-section, hopefully, of the community.
Right. By the way, I was going to make this the closing thought, but what you're talking about right now just brings it to mind. That's the fact that you've been serving in the state Senate mm-hmm. since 1997.
Yeah.
So unlike some who grow weary, you have not grown weary, and even at your age, you are as spry as ever and committed to this. You were, in fact, giving a list of some of your heroes who are older than you are to kind of speak to the whole matter of ages as, you know, as you're as young as you feel.
Yeah, I always tell people, they say, well, Wirch, when are you going to retire? I said, well, I have no plans to retire. I'm younger than Mick Jagger. I'm younger than Ringo Starr. I'm younger than... Bob Dylan, they're all on the job working hard, some of my heroes, and I love the job. And I think it's important to have a cross-section of people. There's some young people, now I'm an older person, but you have the experience to tell people what happened before and give them a different perspective.
Right, yeah, that can be certainly valuable. I even think of, like, where I teach at Carthage, that when we have faculty meetings and there are some of us who are kind of old geezers who have been there for, you know, decades upon decades, and then others who are young and bringing kind of a different sort of energy and perspective, and to have all of those people in the same room working together on the same issues and problems, there's something incredibly rich about that. And what you're saying is that's the best way for instance, the state Senate to function.
Yeah, and I tell people, just because someone is younger doesn't mean they're better.
No. So we are looking at, again, Republican majorities in both the Assembly and the Senate, but narrower majorities than were once the case, you know, thanks to all of the flipping towards Democrat that we were just talking about. So even though you've already said you're not much of a prognosticator, a predictor of the future, how do you foresee the new Assembly and the new Senate functioning with these numbers? And how do you think that's going to affect what happens or does not happen in the next couple of years?
Well, partisanship translates into a lot of party line votes. All the Democrats vote one way and all the Republicans vote the other way. And I'm hopeful with the closer margins between the two parties that we can get back to compromise. I'm sad to say that, unfortunately, compromise has become a dirty word in Washington and in Madison. And I always say that neither Democrats or the Republicans have the corner on wisdom. We have to come together and do what's best for the citizens of the state of Wisconsin and the citizens of this country. That's what I hope. And it will be easier to do that when it's closer. But, and you know, I'll tell you candidly, since I've been there for a while and I have perspective, that happened under Tommy Thompson. I was there for the last term of Tommy Thompson, and he kept the extremists at arm's length and had a moderate approach to running the state of Wisconsin. And I think we have to get back to that. Too much emphasis on party ideology. And, you know, I'll give you an example. I've come up with a plan that's got both sides looking at me like I came from a different planet. And specifically, let me get into the details. We have right around a $4 billion surplus for the state of Wisconsin. More money than we've ever had in the history of this state. And wow. it gets better than that. We have a $4 billion surplus, plus we have more money in the rainy day fund than we've ever had, about $2 billion. That's not much money for Washington, but that's big money for the state. So I introduced legislation, I will reintroduce it, to give the $4 billion back to Wisconsin taxpayers. And I'm telling you, it's just like people look at me like, Wirch, have you gone around a bend? You know, what happened to you? The Republic, first of all, my scheme is, bill simply says you give the same amount of money to the person that works at McDonald's as the CEO. Same amount. And it figures out to about somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500. A nice chunk of change. I am not leaving the cupboard bare. We still have the rainy day fund with $2 billion in it, but I think it's important to give that money back. Well, Republicans don't like it because I'm giving the same amount of money to everybody, and the Democrats look at it and, well, we might be able to use that money somewhere in the future. So I just think that in a time of, what do we talk about? Rising poverty, income inequality, I think this helps that matter by giving a poor family taxpayer $1,500 from the state. That's my idea. But, you know, I'm a Bill Proxmire Democrat, so I'm willing to go against party leadership, and I have on this issue. And I think it's important because, once again, we never had this much money in the history of the state. And let's give it back to the people.
Interesting. So what you're suggesting is it's one of those ideas that is stirring up a fuss on both sides of the aisle.
Yes, yes.
And in some ways, you know, you wear that as a badge of honor, that you're not just interested in cultivating ideas that make your colleagues in the Democratic Party happy, but you want to, you know, follow your own conscience and what you think would be the best for the citizens of the state.
And educate the people that money is their money and it's available, and I want them to put pressure on both Democratic and Republican legislators to give that money back.
Can you explain how that immense surplus has come about? I mean, what is the explanation for it?
A lot of it had to do with the pandemic, and people kind of hunkered down and stayed home and didn't spend as much. And then when they had, when things got better, they had a splurge of spending out there. In other words, they were buying things and they were traveling and whatever. And that brought a lot of extra money into the state through the taxes. And I would say that's the main reason that we have it. And, you know, one thing I love about being a part of state government as opposed to the federal government, we have to run a balanced budget. We don't have the printing press. And so we have to be responsible. And that's a good thing. And people come up to me and they say, well, and they really don't understand government. And I had a lady come up to me and said, how are you going to vote on aid to Israel? I said, well, ma'am, I haven't been to Washington in 25 years. I go to Madison, Wisconsin. I vote on state issues. That's a federal issue. So we're constantly educating people about our role in government and asking them to participate.
Right. Well, we as a state may be sitting on a surplus of, you know, billions of dollars, but on the other hand, these are very lean, challenging times when it comes to the sphere of education. First of all, K through 12 public schools in the state. That's the first thing we should talk about, and the fact that all across the state have been all kinds of referendums for school districts to try to just keep functioning and to keep offering what they are offering to their students. What would you say is going on there that has prompted this situation, and what would you like to see changed?
Well, also, one of the reasons we have that $4 billion surplus, the Republicans refuse to spend money. They don't. I'll give you an example. The governor, you know, it's cold out, it's winter. The governor put $700,000 into the budget to help with the homeless population. That's not much money when you consider we have 72 counties, and that's for 2 years. It would have helped. Republicans took every dollar out of that. And they've been refusing to keep up with inflation for the schools, K through 12. And that has put us into the problem we have now with all the referendums. Plus, they've had an all-out assault on the University of Wisconsin. And I say that because I'm a first-generation college student in my family, and I could only do it because of Parkside. Yet Parkside is laying people off because of the cuts in the state budget. And I'm ashamed to say that in the state of Wisconsin, out of 50 states, we are 45th in funding our state school, the UW. And that's wrong. You know, you can argue demographics and they're changing and stuff like that, but we're still 45th. And quite frankly, a lot of our professors are leaving. And you know, we have to have a good education. I believe in education is the path to the middle class and to prosperity in this country. And we have to fund education. And unfortunately, the Republicans, through their control of the Joint Finance Committee, have refused to spend money on education. And I could go on and on. And yes, we have to have a balanced budget, but we also have to fund basic needs.
If you were in a position to make the changes that you think should be made, let's talk first of all about just K through 12 public schools. Is it a matter of just giving them more money, or is it about adjusting some formulas? I mean, were you in a position to enact those changes, what kind of changes would you like to see occur? K through 12 education.
K through 12, I would certainly adjust the formula. As I say, you have to be careful with the taxpayers' dollar, but on the other hand, you have to recognize inflation out there. People want an increase in wages, health insurance goes up, whatever. So certainly we should adjust for inflation. And, you know, the shameful thing, too, is the way that the Republicans talk about the University of Wisconsin. I mean, they talk about they're indoctrinating students and how terrible it is. And quite frankly, they've been more willing to fund the tech schools in this state because they see it as a feeder system for business. But I think you need the UW, too. So I would say respect education and listen. And certainly we've K through 12, we've underfunded special needs too. We haven't given enough money, and that is a great burden on our public school system. And it's something that should be done to help children with disabilities, but it's hard to do that when you have to take money from other parts of the budget to help children with disabilities.
Right. One of the things that I thought was kind of remarkable is this past November that there were so many referendums all across the state for K through 12 school districts. I mean, first of all, that was, you know, a bit of a shock to me, at least. But also what was shocking to me is how many of those referendums passed. And of course, I think I can easily remember a day, I know you can too, when it was really incredibly difficult for even much needed, you know, referendum motions to pass. But that was that many referendums, not all, but many were successful, which points, it seems to me, to a fairly substantial commitment to education among the population of Wisconsin. Do you see it that way as well?
Well, I see the right-wing Republican majority in both houses being out of touch with the people in Wisconsin. All you have to do is, yes, they got elected, but all of the public opinion polls show that parents, people want good education in their community. I could go on and on. They want medical marijuana, but the Republicans refuse to do that. They want a higher minimum wage. It's shameful that here in Wisconsin we have a $7.25 minimum wage. When you can drive over the border in Illinois, it's $14 an hour. Hmm. Michigan and Minnesota, it's about $10 an hour. So, yes, these Republicans are frugal, but they're not listening to the public opinion polls out there. And, you know, hopefully things will change.
How about UW funding? I believe there was a study that was recently done by a committee chaired by Representative Amanda Nedweski from Pleasant Prairie. What can you tell us about that study of the UW system, and what do you think is ahead?
Well, the head of the UW has said that they need a big chunk of money to catch up in this budget. And if they get the chunk of money, they will not raise tuition. But they'll have to raise tuition if they don't get the money. But the committee that Chair Nedweski did also brought forth some ideas about splitting Madison off from the rest of the UW system and things like that. And I worry, quite frankly, about the future of Parkside. And Speaker Voss has said things like, well, maybe it should be a two-year school. I don't think that's a bad idea. And I just think that they need to listen to the UW. There's anger at the UW. They see it as too liberal. Liberal? I'm an old guy. I remember what it was like in the 60s when they had, I mean, crazy. I mean, to me, I know a lot of UW students. All they want is a good job and become, pay back their loans and stuff like that. So I think the Republicans have an outdated concept of the UW. And, you know, let's remember when Tommy Thompson was the governor, he bragged about the University of Wisconsin. He bragged about the partnership with the UW. He bragged about how it was helping our state. So things have really changed from moderate Tommy Thompson to today when it's open season on the UW system.
Hmm. That, of course, is just one component of this upcoming budget battle in terms of kind of shaping not only, you know, what do we do with this surplus? Do we sit on it or spend it or give it back or whatever? But a lot of other decisions that need to be made in terms of putting together this next budget. I think it might be helpful if you would explain to our listeners what that process is. I mean, how does the state budget take shape? Who crafts it? Who has to approve it? What does that process look like? What does that timeline look like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me make a comment on the budget before I get into that. There's a wild card in this process, meaning that we get a big chunk of money from the federal government. And right now, Elon Musk and I think it's Doggy or whatever the name of the committee is, are looking at ways to slash the federal budget. So there's a real chance that we might get reduced revenue from the federal government that would affect Medicaid and other programs. So that's the wild card we don't know about. But the process is simply this. The governor went around the state and he has solicited input into his budget. He will be doing the state of the state actually next week. talking about his general goals. And then in February, he will present the budget to the legislature. Then the all-powerful Joint Finance Committee, which, by the way, has 16 members, 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats, so you can see the overwhelming majority the Republicans have there.
Wow.
The Joint Finance Committee will go through the budget line by line, have the agencies in there defending what they want, and 80% of the final budget comes out of Joint Finance. Once it comes out of Joint Finance, I'm not sure which house it goes through, either the Assembly or the Senate. Then it's the budget is debated, changes are made, and then it goes to the governor. And the governor then has his veto pen, and he can make changes in the budget. Now, hopefully this process is done by June 1st, somewhere around there, early June, because our fiscal year runs from July 1st to July 1st. And the budget is very important because local government gets money from the state. So local government can't do their budgets until they find out how much money they get. Gateway, City of Kenosha, the County of Kenosha, towns, villages, school districts, all wait to see how much money they get from the state so they can do their own budgets. So it's kind of important that we have a timely process and get done certainly before July 1st.
Right. So even though the margins between the two parties are narrower than they once were, it sounds like one of the things you're laying out for us is that the makeup of the finance, Joint Finance Committee, is still very much tilted towards the one party.
Yes.
And so in terms of what our budget process looks like, that's going to be as important a factor as anything.
Right. And I'm hopeful. I mean, let me give you an example. Housing is a big issue. And in the last budget, we came together. Rare where Democrats and Republicans came together to put $550 million into building housing around the state. I mean, it's important, as important in Rhinelander as it is in Racine and Kenosha. And one right-winger on Joint Finance put some language into this $550 million that all of a sudden made it bad. So you can't use it with historic preservation, and you can't use it with TIF districts. Well, I went and visited developers. They said, you know what? We're not going to do it. So developers said, we're not going to do it because of that language. So the shameful thing is we've only spent $15 million out of the $550 million. It's sitting there because of the bad language that one Republican put in the budget. So that's a delay that's shameful, but hopefully in this session we can get rid of that language and do what the private developers want to do in building this working class housing. So we should have listened to the developers in the first place, and now we've had this long delay.
Right. We're speaking with State Senator Robert Wirch today on the morning show, and I wanted to be sure that we took a moment to talk about somebody whom you greatly admired, whom we lost recently, and that would be Tim Cullen. Speaking of legends in the history of Wisconsin politics, he certainly was one. And I want to mention to our listeners that sometime late in 2024, you passed on to me a book that Tim Cullen had written on the topic of gerrymandering, something that has been a really important cause for him for a number of years. And unfortunately, by the time I finally got around to reaching out to him, he had begun to succumb to the illness that ultimately and shockingly claimed his life. And so we were not able to have that conversation. I grieve that lost opportunity. I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about Tim Cullen, how you knew him, what you most admired about him.
Tim Cullen was a elected representative, state senator from Janesville, Wisconsin. He bragged that this shows you how hard work can do. He won a seat in a 42% Democratic district. So he did it by knocking on doors and going out there. And then he became a majority leader for the Democrats way back when the Democrats were in the majority. That's a long time ago. And then he did something that shocked a lot of people. He became a cabinet secretary in the Tommy Thompson administration, which shows you Tommy was willing to hire a Democrat, and he was willing to work in a Republican administration. He was head of Health and Human Services. Then he left for a 20-year career in the private sector with Blue Cross Blue Shield. So he had quite a background, but then he decided to run for the state Senate again, and he saw the terrible partisan mess that we have in the state Senate. And he quit after one term, and he wrote three small books on the state legislature to educate people about what's going on. The third and final book was on gerrymandering. And Tim, first of all three books he paid for out of his own pocket to publish and gave all of the profits to charity. But the third book was criticizing both sides, Democrats and Republicans, on gerrymandering and saying we should have a neutral third party like they do in Iowa, draw the maps. And so that's what he believed in. And he actually went around the state giving little speeches with a Republican. Dale Schultz was another Republican leader, and they were both former senators. And one Democrat, one Republican went to the libraries and different areas of the state and preach to people that we should have fair maps, not Democratic maps, not Republican maps. And that was what he was doing until his unfortunate death.
One of the things that he mentions in the book, and one of the things you were very quick to say, is that as he writes about gerrymandering, he is very even-handed.
Yes.
And that this is not something that just the Republicans do. It's something the Democrats have done as well. And one of the things he pointed out in terms of the history of gerrymandering in the state of Wisconsin is early in the book, he points to his own Democratic Party as having really dropped the ball when it comes to gerrymandering. And that was back in maybe 2009 or 2010. Explain to our listeners what he was talking about in terms of the way in which your own party failed to act on gerrymandering in a way that might have been really meaningful.
Yeah, it's been a long time, but we the Democrats, had all three branches, and that's how you make major change when you have all three branches, the governors and the governorship and the assembly and the Senate around 2010, and we could have put in the Iowa model, but we didn't. And Tim always pointed out both parties want power. Democrats think that they have all the answers on the future for the state. The Republicans think, no, they got all the answers. And and so, it's just important to have the Iowa model in there. And, you know, both parties love power, and we have to get away from that. We have to get back to compromise. It's the right way, and I'm hopeful that we can do it in the future. But it only happens when the people rise up and say, look, cut the partisan garbage and let's get back to doing what's best for the people.
I wonder, when you are in Madison, what kind of relationship do you try to foster, for instance, across the aisle? And what opportunities are there for you to perhaps even befriend, but otherwise to at least connect with meaningfully and respectfully with people who see the world, see the state maybe very differently than you do? What are the avenues that exist by which that kind of thing can happen, if it happens?
Well, candidly, very little of it happens. I just lost a Republican friend, Bob Coles, who decided not to run for re-election. And quite frankly, he mentioned he was punished by his own Republican caucus for some moderate votes that he took. So it's very difficult. We're friendly to each other in the hallways. Once in a while, we get together, but it's a very partisan. I'll give you an example. Republicans are chairs of committees, and they have a bad habit of Democrats introduce legislation, and the Republicans never give the Democrats a hearing on the bill. So it can be like minimum wage. The Democrats introduce bills to increase the minimum wage. Republicans know that's very popular with the people. Might be a tough vote for us. Let's just not give it a hearing, and then it'll die. And that's sadly one of the partisan tricks up there. But the only way that changes is to get the people involved and say, we didn't send you to Madison for that partisan nonsense, and start doing things for the people.
You did mention that one of the things that you have seen play out in terms of Wisconsin politics and the way Wisconsin voters tend to function is that Wisconsinites tend to be a little less party line. That is, the typical Wisconsin voter is a bit more apt to choose the candidate, even if that candidate is not from their own party, as to, opposed to maybe other parts of the country where that's all but unthinkable. And you see at least the typical Wisconsin voter as a independent thinker, to some extent at least. You also said that makes the work of politicians, in a sense, maybe a bit more challenging. Talk about that.
Yeah, I can only say, like in Kenosha, it's a different environment. When my predecessor was in, Joe Andrea, who was a real legend, there were big blocks of Democratic voters who were union members. Well, those big factories have moved out, and people, quite frankly, are more independent these days. There's still the hardline Republicans and the hardline Democrats, but there's a lot more people in the middle. And you have to work to gain their trust and hopefully gain their vote. And you do that by having listening sessions, by knocking on their doors, talking to people, because there's a lot of people out there don't know about government. They're too busy raising a family, paying the bills, and they have a negative opinion of politics. And so the only way you break through that is to walk through their neighborhoods, help them out with their problems. That's old-fashioned, but I think we have to get back to old-fashioned politics. That's good for our democracy, and we need to get the people to participate in the democratic process by knowing the issues and by coming out to vote.
Right. You were telling me that when you first ran for and were elected to the state Senate, that in following Senator Joe Andrea, which we've already talked several times about him as, you know, something of a legend, that you were in actually a really uncomfortable position in terms of the way at least some of his supporters looked at you. Could you just describe what you are talking about, what you experienced back in 1997?
It was tough following a legend in Joe Andrea. Democrats loved him, and a lot of Republicans loved him. And the first thing they said, hey, that Wirch is no Andrea. We can take him out. And so I was the number one target of the Republican Party for, I don't know, first couple, three elections after Joe retired. In fact, my toughest race was against Reince Priebus. Reince Priebus came down, and he kept telling people, he pointed at me and he said, insanity is electing the same person over and over again. I'm the new person that should help. My comeback was, no, insanity is electing a corporate lawyer from Milwaukee who says he's going to help the middle class. And, you know, Reince Priebus went on to work on the White House, and he was head of the Republican Party. He could shake the money tree. He had three times the money I had, and I was the incumbent. And he was up on network television with commercials against me and stuff like that. But we won by doing a grassroots campaign. We didn't get the big money, but we got the average person send us $5 or $15, and we managed to prevail. But that was a tough race. I think I beat him 52-48. So, yeah, that was a tough one. And but they kept saying, he's no Joe Andrea. So I'm thankful to still be around after being the number one target of the Republicans.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, then you were not only successful then, but successful in every reelection bid thereafter. And as we've already touched on, you are feeling healthy and chipper and optimistic and still seem to really enjoy this. Do you foresee yourself doing this for some time to come?
Well, I have no plans for retirement. I love this country, and I'm thankful I was born here, and it's a real privilege to serve the citizens of this area. And I always remember I'm a public servant, and I tell my staff that too, that our job is to educate people, vote on legislation, but to help people with their problems. And that's the philosophy we've kept over the years, and it's hopefully it we can go ahead with that philosophy.
Very good. Well, we really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to join us today on the morning show to have this conversation not only about the state of Wisconsin and the challenges facing the state assembly and state senate, but also your own philosophy as a public servant and the way in which your own office chooses to function in this environment in which we all find ourselves. And I'm so glad that we were able to have this conversation today, and I hope that we can have many more such conversations in the months and years to come. State Senator Robert Wirch, thank you for being my morning show guest today here on WGTD.
Thanks for having me on.
WGTD studios will be closed on Monday because of Martin Luther King Day, but the podcast version of the program will include a conversation with the author of a really interesting book called An Idea Whose Time Has Come, which tells the incredible story of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, something which, of course, Dr. Martin Luther King worked tirelessly for many years. On Tuesday next week, Dana Oswald will join me from the faculty at UW Parkside to talk about a really interesting free community course focused on Homer's The Iliad. We'll talk about that towering work. On Wednesday, several different interviews, including one with an author of a book called How to Chase Change. Next Thursday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for the first time in 2025. To offer his reflection on a number of different events. And a week from today, we'll be talking about the Poets Laureate of both Kenosha and Racine. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and we encourage you to subscribe to the morning show podcast. Look for the morning show with Greg Berg. Today is going to be mostly sunny and relatively comfortable with a high of 46 degrees, but our winds will be up to 35 miles per hour, which will make it feel a bit chillier. Overnight low of 23. Tomorrow, under sunny skies, not as warm as today, with a high of just 22. And by Sunday, under mostly sunny skies, our high on Sunday, 6 above. And Monday and Tuesday, a high of 4 above. Then more reasonable temperatures are expected by the middle of next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine,